Okay, so we'll just get started in a second. Before we get started, I want to introduce Vashti Kenway. She's also from Melbourne and has flown up here for the conference. Vashti is one of the key activists in the Campaign Against Racism and Fascism, which is the big campaign group in Melbourne that organises anti-fascist demonstrations. And campaigns against racism is probably a key area of interest for Vashti. So if people are kind of interested in learning more about some of the other political things Vashti has written and talked about, one of her areas of speciality is the question of race. And if people go out to our bookstore, they'll see the Marxist Left Review, which is the theoretical journal that Socialist Alternative puts out. And Vashti's written a number of articles for it. I'd draw people's attention to the one in this edition, which was summer 2017, which is about the history of concentration camps in Australia, so contextualising places like Manus Island and Nauru. It's a really fantastic article and kind of has a bunch of research that would be pretty difficult for you to get access to anywhere else. So people should make Vashti feel welcome.
All right, well, we're constantly told living in Australia or in the West that we should be extremely grateful that we live in such a wonderful, egalitarian, democratic society. Almost always on the news of a night, there's kind of images that flash to us from around the world of kind of failed states or, you know, democracy's gone awry from Zimbabwe or wherever it might be. But at the same time, as kind of this lie is, I would argue, kind of peddled to us every night, the truth is that capitalism has never been a more unequal society. If people were at the opening night of the socialism conference last night, one of the speakers raised the absolutely shocking statistic that the same amount of wealth as the 3.7 billion poorest of the world's population is amounted to by only 42 billionaires. And in Australia, which is often paraded around as being a completely meritocratic society, one in which social class has ceased to exist, the richest 1% owns more wealth than the bottom 70% combined. And those sorts of divisions in society have only been increasing over the last period of time. And I would argue that that inequality is absolutely no accident. It's structured into the very core, the fundamental dynamic of the way that capitalism operates, which is a class system built on exploitation and competition for profit. On one side of the class divide stands the tiny minority who own and control absolutely vast, unparalleled amounts of wealth and productive resources in the system. So, you know, think of all the people who actually own. Literally, they wake up in the morning and they haven't just woken up. They probably have owned a lot of these things for a while. The factories, the mines, the call centres, the universities, they're the people who control all of the kind of functions and institutions of society. And the very reality that they have to kind of compete to make their profits, is what constitutes them as a capitalist class. Their fortunes improve the more they're able to hold down wages and conditions for workers, cutting their costs, so that they can get an edge over their rivals. So it's a deeply brutish and nasty system. On the other side stands the vast majority of us, the working class, and our labour generates the profits and, in fact, creates all of the wealth in the world, but we get no real democratic control or oversight of any of the factors that determine what society looks like. And you just have to think about all of the things that regulate our lives, whether it's what exactly we do when we wake up in the morning. What if we're a construction worker, what exactly are we making? Do we get a choice to construct a new apartment building in which, in the case of Melbourne, literally stands empty for year after year? Or are we building hospitals that might actually be of some use to someone in society? When we wake up in the morning, do we get to control what our cafe that we might work at is actually making? Well, sometimes, but most of the time it's just some shitty sandwich or something. Do we get to decide whether we burn fossil fuels or we're generating renewable energy? All of these kind of big decisions about what we actually do in our working lives are not up to us. And there are a whole bunch of decisions that parliaments, these so-called wonderful democratic institutions, are like have literally no control over either. Our elected representatives, for instance, don't have any control over, and we'll be talking a bit about this later in the day, what is published in the major daily newspapers every day. Our elected representatives have no control over what actually happens in every single workplace. And a whole bunch of decisions are made in our society by pinstriped, largely men, who are sitting in hushed boardrooms discussing the fates and lives of literally tens of thousands of people across the world, and there is no oversight over anything or any of the decisions that they're actually made. So, also, every single democratic right that exists today was not handed down to us from on high, but won by workers in class struggle, and almost every single time absolutely bitterly resisted by the political establishment. And so you only have to take, for instance, the right to vote, which now, you know, all of our leaders kind of pretend that this was just a wonderful thing that has always existed, you know, in Western democracies forever and always. This was a huge battle which had to be fought and won by literally millions of working class people, in particular in the early industrial period in Britain, you know, when there were demonstrations by organisations like the Chartists, who had to fight tooth and nail for something as simple as it seems to us today, the idea of universal suffrage. The rights for women to vote, clearly another major battle. People had to, women, a lot of them, chained themselves to buildings to demand this right. Very famously, women in England stormed onto, in quite dramatic scenes, raceways and racing tracks and threw themselves in front of racing horses, which seems like quite a terrifying prospect. I'm not sure I'd suggest that to anyone as a political protest movement today. Or you can, I'm staying at home. But they, you know, really had to throw themselves at the system to even eke out what today is considered a very democratic right. So winning these kind of capitalist freedoms required union organising, it required sit-ins, it required strikes, it required mass protests. In fact, all of these rights required a political action which was not confined to, and this will be a theme, I imagine, of the whole conference, asking nicely. Socialists, you might get the vibe, are opposed to asking nicely for anything. We don't think we should have to ask nicely. We think that ordinary people should be able to get what we deserve, which is the world, but we'll get to that later. So beside the facade of Western capitalist democracy also lies a complete economic dictatorship. The economic foundations that shape society, or what Marxists call the relations of production, are fundamentally incompatible with democracy because they actually rely on the systematic exclusion of the majority from exercising control over production, over our own labour, over how it takes place, and over how the resources which we make are allocated in society. And it's that underlying reality of capitalism that is reflected in the political system. And so I want to kind of explain a little bit today why this is the case, but also to outline the politics and approach that we might need to replace the really phony democracy of capitalism with genuine equality and democracy for all. So the question who really has power and influence in capitalist democracy kind of emerges very frequently. In the Western capitalist countries, all citizens supposedly have an equal right to elect representatives to govern on behalf of our interests. Each person gets only one vote come election time, so each citizen is meant to have exactly the same amount of power or influence in politics. One person, one vote, right? That's the kind of basic argument of capitalist democracy. But when we actually unpack it, the idea that you or I have the same sort of influence in society as someone like Gina Reinhart or Andrew Forrest, both mega billionaires who own mines and wealth, and you know, basically, you know, are able to command, you know, not just the labour of tens of thousands of people, but are able to basically get on the phone to Turnbull, or sorry, I've wrote this before. What's his name? What's the new guy? Scott Morrison. That's right. Yeah, just testing. You know, all of these people, and you could pretty much guarantee that, you know, they all have ScoMo's kind of number on speed dial in their phones as well. And outside of kind of the formal, you know, meetings and there's a huge kind of institution, series of ruling class institutions which exist where all politicians, ruling class figures intersect with each other, you know, wine, dine, I don't know, gamble, whatever, I don't know what ruling class people do, but, you know, like do their thing all together. So you think about all of the private schools that exist. Sydney University, like, this is clearly, I mean, just walking up that, you know, fucking just, like, seeing that giant building, which is designed, it's absolutely designed. The architecture is redolent with elite, scornful sort of attitude, and it's designed to kind of send a message to the population down the hill, clearly. But, you know, all of these places and institutions are areas and arenas where ruling class people get together and interact. There's old boys clubs where they discuss through laws what's coming up in Parliament, which bits of legislation should be encouraged through. Oh, what's my interests here? What's yours? You know, can we cut a little deal? This is the reality of the ways in which the ruling class intersects outside of the formal institutions of Parliament. And so the idea that this one person, one vote, and we're all kind of equal in society is just an absolute lie. The British socialist Paul Foote put it really well when he said, "An industrial magnate has one vote, and so does each worker he can fire and impoverish. A millionaire landlord has one vote, and so does each person he evicts. A newspaper proprietor has one vote, and so does each of the readers he deceives or seduces every day of the week. Are all of these people really equally represented? Or does not the mighty, unrepresentative economic power of the wealthy minority consistently and completely overwhelm the representative power of Parliament?" And all of this kind of goes to a broader point about this idea that the capitalist state is just a neutral body which has developed over time and sits above all of the nasty little conflicts which kind of exist in the rest of society. So there's that really famous kind of image of law courts, of the blindfolded woman of justice kind of standing there with the scales, kind of just ruling over society, completely neutral and outside of influence. And the same kind of idea goes for the capitalist state. Again, I think we kind of have to understand the reality of this institution is very different. Marx and Engels said in the Communist Manifesto, "The bourgeoisie, or in less 19th century terms, the capitalist class, has at last, since the establishment of modern industry of the world market, conquered for itself, in the modern representative state, exclusive political sway, so that the executive of the modern state is but a committee for managing the common affairs of the whole bourgeoisie." Now, again, like some of these kind of terms from the Communist Manifesto, they sound kind of grand and a little bit kind of, well, not quite Dickensian, but sort of a little bit, you know, incomprehensible when you're kind of reading them out. But it's worthwhile just breaking them down because they're actually really profound comment on today's society. So when Marx and Engels were kind of talking in this way, they weren't just talking about some sort of conspiracy whereby the heads of business sort of get together to plan out, you know, exactly which laws and governments they want governments to pass. Although, you know, obviously a lot of those conversations do happen on a daily basis. But it's not just some sort of secret cabal, which is kind of sitting in a back room, kind of, you know, organising in smoky rooms, working out how the rest of society will run. The capitalist state exists to enforce the class rule of the rich minority over the rest of us, and it goes beyond the understanding that money determines the ultimate electoral success of candidates or that lobbyists just bribe politicians, although obviously both of those things are features of capitalists. So people might be a bit familiar with the argument that, oh, well, you know, the state is neutral. Part of the issues and problems in the world today is that lobbyists are too strong or that money influence and you just need a lot of money to run in politics. And if we could legislate all of those things out of politics, then actually we'd end up with a much fairer sort of democratic system. And I think to argue that is sort of fine. And, you know, we do want to kind of, make sure that big money is out of politics as much as possible. And we do want to kind of raise awareness about the fact when there has been lobby groups which have kind of influenced parliamentary politics. But all of that sort of misses the point in a bit, because the fundamental dynamic of the capitalist state and of the parliamentary system has always been to back up and enforce in subtle and not so subtle ways the rule of the ruling class and of the wealthiest in our society. That's its whole purpose as an institution. And the capitalist class, in a way, don't directly need control over the state for it to act in their interests. So, you know, like Gina Reinhart's not about to run for parliament, you know, tomorrow. I mean, Trump kind of running for parliament, you know, in a way has kind of bucked some of the trend. But largely, the capitalist class aren't our direct representatives. They kind of operate in concert with and in conjunction with the rule of capital. And so, like, oftentimes the kind of broader questions of the government ruling in the interests of, say, the national economy is the way that this relationship is developed. Since the economy is in the hands of large corporations whose decisions have a huge impact on employment, production, investments and exports, it's just common sense in capitalism that the government's service to the public is best accomplished via its service to the investors and business owners. And so when you think in Australia about the absolutely slavish and bipartisan government support for the mining industry, you'll get kind of a good example of that here. But you kind of don't just have to take my word for it. Like, these people are very explicit about what this relationship between capital and politics is. So, for instance, the Business Council of Australia every year hosts a dinner, if people didn't know, six-course fancy dinner. It's attended by the CEOs of the largest companies and the politicians that they like to kind of remind of their importance. Last year, just at the end of last year, Grant King, who is the president of the Business Council of Australia, introduced the keynote speaker. And the keynote speaker of Australia was our ex-Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull. And he introduced him like this. He said, "Businesses, large and small, employ 10 million of the 12 million working Australians. Businesses support their communities in times of distress. And, of course, the profits business makes support the retirement of millions of Australians. We know from our discussions with the community that they understand the important role that business plays. And contrary to what many say, I believe so do the two major political parties. Prime Minister, we know you understand that with the right policies, big business will thrive and so will small business." So there's nothing subtle about that kind of going, you know, basically, you know, you do us a good one and we'll do you a good one back. And Turnbull replied like this. He said, "Democracy and open markets have been two of the most powerful forces in human history. Political and economic freedom have fostered growth and prosperity around the world, including at home here in Australia. We will not make Australia stronger by winding these freedoms back." Freedoms, the freedom of the market, the freedom of government. "We must instead reinforce and build upon them. The economic freedom to get ahead and carve out your own future, underpinned by the democratic values that define us. A fair go, mutual respect and generosity." So in both of these kind of comments, you can absolutely see the fundamental kind of dynamics at play. So in capitalism, the head of government, the politicians, define democracy as the economic freedom of the capitalist class to make their profits. And this has really absolutely nothing to do with the real meaning of the word democracy, which, you know, if there are any Greek buffs in the room... No, maybe ancient Greek, not just Greek, modern Greek, which means rule of the people. And it's worth noting that at the same time as the Business Council of Australia dinner was happening, the government had just held the plebiscite, which was around equal marriage rights, as a manoeuvre to try and deny the majority of people's position for marriage equality. It obviously backfired on them, but it's a reminder of the kind of lack of democracy in modern Australian capitalism. So I guess some of the response to this might be, well, you would expect that of Turnbull and of the Liberals. They're kind of the major party of Australian capitalism, but what about the Labor Party? And I think, really, we have to kind of see that the Labor Party is subject to exactly the same kind of pressures and dynamics as the Liberal Party itself. An example here was Bill Shorten's backflips on the company tax cuts in July, and when he announced that Labor would repeal tax cuts for businesses with profits of between $10 and $50 million, businesses threw a major tanty. The media happily aired the tirades of the Masters Builders Association and a variety of different other industry groups and threatened that the repeal would cost jobs, and the Labor Party caucus publicly declared their opposition to the leader's announcements. And literally, after less than a week of this kind of pressure, Shorten caved. And that's before Labor are even in government, when the stakes are raised and Labor is expected to show on a much more broad scale that they can actually manage Australian capitalism responsibly or risk media smear campaigns, investment strikes, where the capitalists literally withdraw their money out of the economy and other forms of sabotage at the hands of the capitalists. So, in Western democracy, I hope you can start to see that I'm trying to build a picture that while we may get a vote for representatives, but even in the most liberal countries, this doesn't translate into real power for working class people or real choice. So for a start, there's no provisions in the political system for holding any political representatives to account in between elections. Yeah, we're all really mad. So there are a heap of different kind of examples of this. I've got away with kids. So there's a bunch of different examples, and I'm sure everyone in this room could kind of think of them. But, for instance, the popular opposition to the war in Iraq, for instance, was expressed in some of the biggest demonstrations that ever occurred in Australian history, and yet the government still went to war. For a long time, there was majority support for equal marriage right, and still the government said year after year, both Labor and Liberal, that they would not grant it. There's almost no institutional way in between kind of elections that the rest of the population can actually have an impact on the decisions that the state makes. So, I'll just continue on. So from its outset, capitalist democracy was structured to deny genuine democracy. But historically, the myth of democracy has also acted as a really important safety valve for the capitalist class. If the majority can have their opposition and frustration kind of channeled into elections, this has kind of diffused the general idea that, we do have some say over society. And it basically means that it can leave their system much more stable. There's a very, very widespread kind of general sense that even if there's a bit of frustration about how politics go, that what is the alternative? How could you possibly enact democracy in any more significant way? And really, the kind of very basic realities of our lives, which teach us that we don't have control over what happens in our workplaces, we don't have control over whether we smile at work, what we wear, how we operate, what kind of physical movements we engage in. We can't just break out into dance at work. Maybe some people's work, but, most of the time, what exactly we do at work, we have no control over. And that basic reality also helps fuel a sense that other people do the politics for us, that there are other people who make the decisions, other people who, it's right that there are other people who understand the deep and difficult mechanics of state. And that very basic idea is one of the fundamental, again, ideas of capitalism. Since the global financial crisis, however, with the kind of inequality rising across the world, capitalism has been much more explicitly authoritarian. Successive Western governments have had nothing to offer the working class but austerity. The rich have gotten richer, the corporations pay less taxes, and even in the wealthiest countries in the world, we're told that there's not enough money to fund universal healthcare or education. So the only budgets that basically ever expand are the military budgets, so that the capitalist class of the strongest economies can get a competitive edge over their imperial and economic rivals. And so even in this instance, even though for a bunch of places the capitalist class knows that it is better for them to have some sense of democratic rights in society, even though there is that sense in country after country, I think what we're seeing at the moment is a ruling class which is increasingly relying more and more on repression and strengthening of the coercive arms of the state. And all of this is coupled with, and I'm sure this will become a theme over the conference, the racist scapegoating of immigrants and refugees, Islamophobia, and the politics of border control and national security. So there are a variety of different ways that the ruling class rules, and one of them is through this pretense of kind of democracy and this idea that you can have a say even if it's through your elected representatives, and another way of control is through open authoritarian control over society and division and racism. The far right is politically on the advance, as people would know, and I presume that people have seen the extremely disturbing developments that have happened in Chemnitz in Germany over the last few days, with literally pogroms of explicit neo-Nazis who are going around and attacking migrants. Cops have been deployed in country after country against anti-fascist protesters, and the most supposedly moderate politicians, like Macron in France, have deployed the full force of state repression against workers who have tried to resist a tide of austerity. So there are clearly flaws to this idea of capitalist democracy. It's not unparalleled at all times. Even the kind of meagre elements of democracy that we're granted are often pulled away from us in periods of turmoil or crisis. And what I think we're seeing across the world today is evidence of that. But despite all of that, socialists and Marxists are for pushing for the maximum extensions of democratic rights where we can, even though we recognise that they're very limited. So all of this, I think, means that we look to the kind of histories of workers' struggles that demonstrate what real democracy might look like and talk about the possibilities of different kinds of democratic processes that could emerge through struggles and through resistance. And in writing this talk, I was kind of talking to a bunch of different people and asking around about, what are some of your favourite examples from kind of democratic moments, high points in democratic moments through kind of working class struggle. Hit me up with some. I got a bunch. And, once people start talking, there's kind of like a lot of wonderful kind of examples that people could give. And I thought about including some of other people's examples and then decided to just include my own. So on my bedroom wall is a beautiful... this is going somewhere, yeah. We're all friends in this room. One of the most beautiful pictures. It's of the Egyptian Revolution in 2011, and of one of the magnificent demonstrations that came and occupied the square against the dictatorship of 30 years in that place. It's of the masses of people in the square, and all of their faces are turned up to look at this young woman who is giving a speech from one of the big platforms that they kind of erected at one end of the square. And what I love about this image is that it really demonstrates the kind of possibilities that are released in these moments of struggle. This is just a young woman, and if you read anything about the Egyptian Revolution, you would know that there were thousands of people who had never spoken in public, who had never thought to or been able to give a political opinion in public because of the levels of repression that existed in Egyptian society, who, in the context of this mass outpouring of struggle, all of a sudden found it somewhere in themselves to get up in front of tens and tens of thousands of people and make an argument about what they thought should happen in the revolution itself. And it's not just, they found the confidence. It's that the whole dynamic of the struggle pushed all of these sorts of debates to occur. So, you're in the middle of a square, you're starting to raise questions about a dictatorship, and all of a sudden there are all of these right-wing forces which come into the square. What are people going to do? it's not just automatic that everyone's like, oh, we should just go and blockade that part of the square, or we should get our friends to come down, or we should write an article, or we should get onto some of the trade unions and we should try and get them to come down, or we should try and talk to the rank and file in the military. All of those sorts of answers to that very basic question, what do we do, had to be debated out. And that is what democracy in struggle actually looks like. What happened in Egypt was not a workers' revolution, but when workers' revolutions have occurred, all of those little examples about what do we do, what happens next, how can we organise, how can we begin to challenge what are the big iniquities of the system and the small iniquities of the system, all come to the fore. And in workers' revolutions, all of those things happen, you know, simultaneously in tens and tens of thousands of workplaces, on the streets, in high schools, and even in some wonderful kind of revolutionary moments in kindergartens, you know, kids kind of talking about what should happen and so on. There's another really and slightly more dramatic example from Bolivia in 2006. When there was a major uprising of working class people against austerity that happened there. If people kind of, Bolivia is quite a hilly country, as far as I understand from the descriptions that I've read. And there's just this kind of wonderful description, again, of teachers and miners and locals who lived in some of the kind of barrios, which are up on the hillside of the town. They meet up at the hillside, decide to march down into the centre of La Paz, which is kind of, you know, where a bunch of the kind of major administrative kind of centres of the country are, and the teachers and all of the kind of local communities and a bunch of other workers are kind of in the centre of the demonstration. The miners head up the front of the demonstration and they march down the hill. The miners are throwing dynamite kind of like and fireworks kind of as they come down the hill. So it's a very dramatic kind of moment. They kind of get down to the bottom of the hill and gather with almost 500,000 other workers from across the town. And they vote. Hands up in the air, they decide to nationalise all of the hydrocarbons and a bunch of the other industries in the town. And then they immediately leave from there, they organise themselves to get out from there and then to go and occupy the centres of power, the headquarters of the various different companies. That is what real democracy looks like, not this bullshit that we're given, you know, handed down to us, oh, go in here and fill out this kind of ballot. You know, that is the kind of vision of real democracy that I think can be opened up with working class struggle. And again, there are just many, many different examples of this kind of democracy and institutions like Soviets, workers' councils. You might hear these sorts of terms over the course of this conference. These are the basic institutions of working class people getting together and answering that question again and again. What should we do? What do we have to do to actually take on the system and to fight for a better world, that, you know, one in which we might actually have a decent life and be experiencing genuine democracy? And so if people want a little bit more example of what that might actually look like, in one of the most wonderful examples of this in 20th century history, there's a session on later today on the Russian Revolution and, you know, actually reclaiming from all of that kind of stolid, awful history, the way people often get taught it at university or at high school, and really talking about the wonderful kind of year of 1917 and the structures and, you know, ways in which working class people began to build up democratic structures in their lives. So you should get along to that at 4:30 today. So just to conclude, from the workplaces to the corridors of Parliament, authority, not democracy, is the defining political characteristic of capitalism. Every single important decision that affects our lives is set beyond the reach of the majority. Parliamentary or representative democracy, far from safeguarding the interests and equal rights of all, is an extremely limited and flawed system which we infrequently get to choose unaccountable representatives to do the biddings of the capitalists. And it's only part of a vast and unaccountable state that every single day acts through all of its different arms to uphold the exploitation and competition around which capitalist society is structured. So democracy can't get around or ignore the social reality of a class society ruled by profit in which it's embedded. And really, the vast majority of us, the vast majority of the world's population of the working class, has an interest in fighting for the truest and most complete democracy. And all of that kind of wonderful history of working class struggle really demonstrates that. But every single victory that we have won always has to be fought for and maintained. And hopefully that's part of what the project of this conference is all about. Thank you.